Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome.
It is Sunday. We are broadcasting live out of Roberta's. I'm not sure what the date is, March 20-something. We are broadcasting live out of Roberta's. How's it going, Jack?
It's the 25th.
25th. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah.
It's we are Roberta's at 261 Moore Street. A lot of construction going on here, huh, Jack?
Oh, my God.
It's dangerous to walk back there
now. The last 2 weeks have been challenging, man.
Really?
There's like jackhammers in the back while we're doing shows, but, you know, we fought through.
You seem very harried. Are you okay? You're feeling all right?
I feel great, actually.
So great job at the party today. Oh, first of all, I want to thank our sponsor, Kame 5. I mean, what a great guy. He's so into that piece of land where he raises those five varietals and in Napa Valley. And just, it's a great, great wine.
He listens to the shows a lot, which I really appreciate.
Well, now we know who our listener is.
That's right.
So you did a great job at the party. It was the 100th anniversary party, wasn't it?
Yeah, you did a great job too. It was good all around. Lots of fun.
So who was honored? Let's go through some of this list. Because 100 episodes, that's a real shining achievement. I mean,
I'd say so too, yeah.
You know, diversity, you know, consistency, stubbornness to come in, whether it's hot or cold. I mean,
absolutely.
These hosts have done an unbelievable job for the show, for the network, for the archive.
Yeah, it dawned on me, though, that you didn't get to speak because your show's hit way over 100.
What do you
now.
Mean? You and I were emceeing the whole thing.
Yeah, but, you know, did you get pinned? Yeah, actually.
I said like 5,000 words. So
fair enough.
Let's go. Yeah, you pinned me, actually. That was always, I learned from Lewis and Clark. I was always amazed how Lewis and Clark, they didn't lose any casualties. They didn't have any casualties due to, you know, Indian fighting. They lost one guy, I think, to like an appendicitis. But they only killed one Indian, the Blackfeet, who were then forever the enemies of the Western settlers. But I learned that. I was like, how did they not fight with any of these Indians? And the answer is that when they would encounter them, they would do a big ceremony and give out awards and trinkets and pin people with things. And that was like a real secret. So if you have to make a speech,
if not for
give
that
out
party,
awards.
There would have been mutiny. That's what you're saying.
There would have been mutiny. So tell us, who was, take us through the list, Jack. Top 100.
Well, these are all the shows that have hit 100. Not all the hosts were there, but as I said, the main course, Erica Wides with her two shows, Why We Cook and Let's Get Real. Snacky Tunes, Kathy Irway, and Let's Eat In.
Kathy Irway was there. The Snacky Tunes guys were there.
They were. Of course, Beer Sessions proudly hit 100.
Beer Sessions.
And you know, what makes Beer Sessions a little bit more impressive, I think, is how many guests have been there. You know, multiply 100 times 4 or 5.
Yeah, because they always have like a group in here.
Exactly.
No, they're very impressive. And of course, Jimmy helped.
He was the event organizer. Jimmy did it. Yeah, he did a great job with the party.
He did really great job. And I mean, he is a publican. I don't even really know exactly what that means, but it's perfect for him.
Yeah,
you know,
right,
he
exactly.
is a true publican.
Let's see, who else? Unfiltered, the wine show, which was at the root of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Farm Report in its many iterations.
Wow, so do you have a couple clips?
Let's see, I've got a clip of Nicole Taylor, which I'm saving best for last here.
How many did she do?
She's over 100 now, too, and she was popping bottles on air and everything, so.
Well, let's hear her pop.
Nicole, it's Heather Jones from the Blacker the Berry Food, just wishing you a happy 100th episode of Hot Grease. Keep doing what you do, introducing us to the best and the brightest of the good food movement.
Okay, so we're about to party. We're going to take the last few minutes. I'm going to see who's on Twitter saying congratulations. A few of the people have called in. We've just popped a bottle. That's why I played the, you know, Kanye West.
Yeah.
You think anyone got that?
You like my live editing there?
Guess
huh? I said, you like my live editing?
Right. I was like, man, I hope that's the clean version.
No, it wasn't.
We have, you know, nice people like Nancy McDermott listening.
That's what
all
I'm saying.
Those B words. She would have been like, oh my gosh, Nicole.
Yeah, Nicole had fun.
Oh, brother.
Nicole was kind of drunk by the end of it, actually.
Was she?
Yeah.
So it's good to know you weren't the only one. Do you ever drink back there? Or you're always so amazing how fast you type and you have three computers going and you're doing searches to confirm spelling for the tagging. I mean,
when it was a two-man job back here back in the day where all you would do is either engineer or tag, then maybe I had a few more drinks, but yeah.
Well, Jack, not anymore. Always said of the all the people that ever worked back there, you're in the top 50 percentile.
Sweet.
And I mean that.
Thanks.
So, well, let's take a break. We have a very interesting show. I'm actually going to read. I was just talking about that. You know, did I tell you, were you going to mention it, that Frances McDormand interviewed me for NPR?
Bring this up. Yeah, that's incredible. How did that even happen?
Through this Davia Nelson, who has an NPR show called
Kitchen
Lost.
Sisters.
Yeah, Kitchen Sisters, and she also does Lost and Found Sound, which is just kind of sound. So she's like, can I interview you? And then it turned out to be Frances McDormand,
so Frances
which is
McDormand
such an honor.
Interviewed you.
Yes.
About?
It was really about Alice Waters' 30th anniversary party. And I had been asked to, well, I just flew out there and was like, put me to use. I'm here to help.
Right.
So they have me be the a bus entertainer. So it was, I was an entertainer in this little bus for people who were too frail, basically, to walk to the event space from the parking lot. So I was very, very funny. And I told her, you know, that I rented the movie Speed to like 50 times to prepare for like even the worst case scenario. God forbid, you know, George Lucas is in the back with like a broken knee or something like that. I would save him. Anyway, so that was super cool. And we, you know, I showed her this pre-copy I have of the Prince's speech, which is Prince Charles's speech on the future of food. So it was a little publication they made from a speech he made at Georgetown University. So she was so interested by it, and I was kind of psyched to have this early copy. So I thought I would read a couple of the quotes from Prince Charles and from Wendell Berry, who did the introduction, and from Eric Schlosser, who did the afterword. And then we have Harris and Adam on, who are going to talk about Underground Eats, which is a very, you know, kind of talking about alternative dining experiences and how to find them for people. So it's going to be a good show. Let's take a break, and I'll come back and read from Future Food.
Had me a job till the market fell out. Tried hard to borrow, but there was no help. Now I've got nowhere to go. I need a job for these two hands. I'm a working man. Nowhere to go. One last look at the land. Auctioneer with his gavel in hand, and he said, it's got to go. Work this piece all my life.
The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
Nowhere to go. Wandered aimless in the city.
All right, so welcome back to the main course. We're sponsored by Cane 5. I'm going to read something from On the Future of Food, which is HRH, the Prince of Wales, His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales, HRH. So this is from the foreword by Wendell Berry. In Washington, D.C., on May 4th, 2011, Prince Charles delivered a speech, the text of which is provided in this little book, and which was, by any measure, remarkable. It was most certainly a challenge to conventional assumptions, but it was nothing like the speeches on public issues that we are getting accustomed to in the U.S. It was not a volley of angry slogans and loose assertions. On the contrary, Prince Charles's terms were clearly defined. His argument was made carefully and in detail. His speech was quietly voiced, and the more powerful for that. He did not speak as a blinkered partisan of a side, but rather as a human to other humans, of concerns urgently important to us all. He said that we humans are under obligation to increase, quote, the long-term fertility of the soil. He said that we need, quote, a form of agriculture that does not exceed the carrying capacity of its local ecosystem, and which recognizes that the soil is the planet's most vital renewable resource. He said that we need to do everything possible and use the best new technology to conserve water. He said that social and economic stability is built upon valuing and supporting local communities and their traditions, and that smallholder agriculture, therefore, has a pivotal role. He said, capitalism depends upon capital, but our capital ultimately depends on the health of the nature's capital. There is nothing extreme or odd in anything I have quoted, or in the speech as a whole, which amounts exactly to the good sense that we once recognized as common. That this sense is now so rarely spoken, and that a prominent man needs rare courage to speak it, tells how highly we should value this speech and how fortunate we are to share the world in our difficult time with this speaker. That's Wendell Berry. So I just pulled out four kind of quotes from Prince Charles's speech. So what is a sustainable food production system? We should be very clear about it, or else we will end up with the same system that we have now, but dipped in, quote, greenwash. For me, it is to be a form of agriculture that does not exceed the carrying capacity of its local ecosystem, and which recognizes that the soil is the planet's most vital renewable resource. Topsoil is the cornerstone of the prosperity of nations. It acts as a buffer against drought and as a carbon sink, and it is the primary source of the health of all animals, plants, and people. If we degrade it as we are doing, then nature's capital will lose its innate resilience, and it won't be very long before our human economic capital and economic systems also begin to lose their resilience. Let's look for a moment at what very probably is not a generally sustainable form of agriculture in the long term. And by that, I mean generations as yet unborn. In my own view, it is surely not dependent upon the use of chemical pesticides, fungicides, and insecticides, nor, for that matter, upon artificial fertilizers and growth promotants or genetic modification. You would have perhaps thought a generally sustainable agriculture system would be unlikely to create vast monocultures and to treat animals like machines by using industrial rearing systems. Nor would you expect it to drink the earth dry, deplete the soil, clog streams with nutrient-rich runoff, and create, out of sight and out of mind, enormous dead zones in the oceans. You would also think, wouldn't you, that it might not lead to the destruction of whole cultures or the removal of many of the remaining small farms around the world. Nor, presumably, would you destroy biodiversity at the same time as cultural and social diversity. So then he says, we did a study why sustainable food production systems struggle to make a profit. And how is it that intensively produced foods cost less? So this is what he said. My group looked at five case studies and discovered two things. Firstly, that the system of farm subsidies is geared in such a way that it favors overwhelmingly those kinds of agricultural techniques that are responsible for many of the problems I have just outlined. And secondly, that the cost of the damage is not factored into the price of food production. You know, all things we've heard before, but I mean, he says it with kind of style. Then this is another quote. The fact is that food production is part of a wider socio-economical landscape. We have to recognize that social and economic stability is built upon valuing and supporting local communities and their traditions. Smallholder agriculture, therefore, has a pivotal role. Imagine if there were a global food shortage, if it became much harder to import food in today's quantities. Where would countries turn to for their staple foods? Is there not more resilience in a system where the necessary staple foods are produced locally, so that if there are shocks to the system, there won't be panic? Then he writes, and he said at Georgetown, essentially, we have to do more today to avert the catastrophes of tomorrow, and we can only do that by reframing the way we approach the economic problems that confront us. We have to put nature back at the heart of the equation. If we are to make our agricultural and marine systems and therefore our economies, resilient in the long term, then we have to design policies in every sector that bring the true cost of environmental destruction and the depletion of natural capital to the fore and support an ecosystem-based approach. And we have to nurture and support the communities of small holders and family farmers. Really, really well written. Just a couple more, or one more. I like the way he ends it. He says, "It was George Washington who entreated your forebears to raise a standard to which the wise and honest can repair. The rest is in the hands of God." And indeed, as is so often in the past, in the hands of your gay country, the United States of America. Wow, nice. That must have gotten a lot of applause.
Yeah,
and
really.
Then, yeah, one last quote, just because Eric Schlosser, you know, he wrote the afterword. So just one short quote just about the wealthy, because he taught me once that, you know, all the great social movements start with an educated elite. And he gave as examples the woman suffrage movement, the civil rights movement, the environmental movement. So anyway, this is a little quote from him in the afterword. He writes, "The wealthy will always eat well. It is the poor and working people in the United States who need a new sustainable food system more than anyone else. They live in the most polluted neighborhoods. They are exposed to the worst chemicals on the job. They are sold the most processed, unhealthiest foods. And they can least afford the health problems that result." So anyway, pretty powerful stuff, huh, Jack?
It sounds a lot like a Heritage Radio program.
Does it?
Yeah, man.
I didn't know of reading a lot of from those, a book.
No, really. I'm saying, you know, his speech echo a lot of the sentiments that get shared here every week.
And, you know, yeah, he's very good. It's important to have someone so important actually say them, you know.
Right.
And he's also done more for rare breeds. It's funny, the English are way ahead of the Americans in terms of respecting their traditions.
They always have been, too, right?
Yeah.
With the breeds.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so in fact, a lot of the breeds we sell at Heritage Foods are, you know, of English descent. And he maintains Highland cattle on his farms, right. And, you know, puts, I think, a lot of money towards, you know, small groups that, you know, might work to preserve Berkshire genetics or, you know, revive sure. The Tamworth hog as an, you know, economic force in a certain village. So, yeah, really, really interesting guy. And, you know, it's funny, the only time you hear politicians in the U.S. like really give powerful, forceful, like, "I don't care what you think of me after this speech," speeches is like in the movies.
Yeah, right. I've been watching West Wing a lot lately.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I always remember the one with, what was the one? It was a Rob Reiner film. I think it was called The American President.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like at the end of that speech, he gives a big thing. Anyway, hopefully Barack Obama, you know, will find his voice and get into a groove this this holiday season and, you know, kind of say some things that, you know, most people don't say.
Yeah.
So let's take a break and then we're going to come back and talk about Underground Eats.
Hey, before we take a break, I have to thank you. I picked up two Heritage ribeyes.
Really?
At the meat shop from Silva.
Way to go for the most expensive cut, Jack.
It was his fault.
You don't know what love is. You think that it's a toy, a pretty little game played by a girl and boy. You won't talk about it. You don't even care. And you just take for granted I'll always be there.
You play, you stay away from anything that might be real. You talk and then you walk. I pray so. You know how bad it feels. You don't know what love is.
Welcome back to The Main Course. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's. We're sponsored by Cane Vineyards. I'm Patrick Martins, the host of The Main Course. We're produced and engineered by Jack Inslee. And in studio, we have Harris and Adam, the founders of Underground Eats. Welcome, guys.
Hey, thanks, Patrick.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
So should it be called Huge? Or that's just your acronym?
UGE, sometimes we go by. But yeah, Underground Eats.
Well, it's going to be huge.
Yeah.
So, before we get into exactly what you do, like, tell us about what is an alternative dining experience. Give us some examples.
Sure. You know, the way that we define alternative dining, actually, Adam says it best. I'll let Adam.
Oh, thank you. You're too kind. The way we see it is basically anything that's not going to a restaurant and ordering off the menu like you have 1,000 times before. So it's something a bit experiential or unconventional. It can range anything from a special tasting menu at a chef's table where you have access at the chef with the restaurant to, on the far spectrum, something like a dinner with a Michelin-starred chef in an abandoned subway station, right? So it's pulling in a lot of elements where food is kind of the foundation, but then you have kind of art or music or theater or anything that kind of elevates that experience to something that you're going to remember a year from now and be telling your friends about.
Very interesting. So, I mean, how did you come up with this idea? Had you been to one of these events, or?
Yeah, you know, it was something that hit me actually at Pig Island, which is Patrick Carbone's.
Jimmy
event,
Carbone.
Right? Jimmy Carbone.
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
Patrick.
No, it's funny. I was going to just say, there's a small world.
Absolutely. Yeah, I happened upon it, and pig and pork products happen to be have a very soft spot in my heart. And I happened to be going for a bike ride there and saw signs for Pig Island, and it really just seemed to be kismet or divine intervention, just bringing my bike to this place where there were 40 heritage pigs and amazingly passionate chefs and 6 points beer and all of these things. And all these things combined to create kind of a magical experience that, you know, maybe the environment or techniques were not as high-minded as you might experience at some of the best restaurants in New York, but the passion and the setting and the people really elevated it, and that really started getting me thinking about, you know, food really obviously has taken off over the last 10 years or more as, you know, more than just sustenance. It's really a passion and something that you and this radio station elevate all the time. But for us, it was just kind of a lightning bolt of inspiration. And then we started doing research and found all these people out there in the community who were agitators and jokers and jesters and really interesting, creative people doing amazing things with food. And we kind of latched onto that. And then, you know, really one thing led to another, and we developed this concept for Underground Eats.
So have you done, I mean, give us an idea of some of your couple of favorite events and why.
Absolutely. Our first event, so while we were still getting involved in the scene, we decided we have to actually just jump in and get our feet wet. And we worked with Do or Dine not too far from here over in Bed-Stuy, and those guys are doing some really interesting things with food, and they've got a great attitude where they just don't care about what's been done before. And we went to them and we said, and this is really what we like to do, is you have a menu, their menu's crazy, but a lot of chefs have a traditional menu that they work with all the time. And we said, what would you do if you had the gloves off? If you could do anything you wanted, what would it be? And, you know, it kind of took inspiration from their, you know, most infamous or famous dish, depending on your orientation, their foie gras filled dough donut. And we did. We came up with a concept called BDGA Kitchen, which was a 7-course dinner, and it was based on all high-end ingredients and literally things we could get at the bodega around the corner. So we had, obviously Colt 45s for everyone to start, and then we had Hamachi Tira Dorito, which is hamachi covered in Cool Ranch Doritos, which, by the way, is an amazing combination. Chilled chanterelle soup with
there
a
was
Colt
just
45.
An article in the Times about how Doritos and chips, the Tostitos chips, are now part of, like, John T. Edge wrote it. It was in the back of the food section talking about how food traditions are evolving. Yeah, that's interesting. You're ahead of your time.
A couple of my friends have actually said that they have gone to Taco Bell and had the Dorito shell. I haven't gone that far. I'm not sure I'm about to. But
this sounds like a good. So then you did that. You were
so
saying?
We did that, and we had an amazing response. And what we found was that, you know, the food was central, but we surrounded it by a lot of cultural elements.
Yeah, I mean, we went so far as to actually build a serviceable bodega in their backyard, where it was fully stocked with everything from candy to maybe even Lucy's, if you're familiar with the bodega underground cigarette, to detergent, literally anything you could buy at a bodega. And we thought that would really bring kind of the whole environment around. We also had an art installation where we photographed all of the local Bed-Stuy bodega owners and had that kind of displayed as you walked in to really create that atmosphere.
That's cool. So does a chef come first, or does an idea come first and then you fill it in with the chef?
Ideally, I think, you know, we have ideas, you know, that go on forever. But ideally, I think the best events come from a collaboration between a chef who's really passionate and has an idea. And, you know, what we like to do is there's some amazing chefs out there. They may not be the big, bold-faced names, but they're working with those people, and you're working on the line and you're cooking 50 duck breasts a night and to perfection, but maybe you want to do something else. And really what we like to do is approach chefs and say, what would you do if you had your druthers? And we try to like make those dreams a reality.
Is it always like hypercaloric? Like, is it super, super high calories usually?
I think we foresee all types of events on the low end, we love street food and things that aren't so high minded. And we also love amazingly decadent meals to vegetarian food. So, you know,
what are some of the most exotic ingredients that you've been asked to source?
I think the hardest was the Colt 45 gelée. That involved a lot of molecular gastronomy and a couple of rounds of tries to get that right.
Now, Colt 45 used to have as their spokesperson none other than
Billy D. Williams.
Jack, if you can pull up that clip, Colt 45 is the dynamite taste. That's old school.
Love it.
Yeah, Han Solo. Oh, I know. He was. What was his name?
Here it goes.
Colt 45. There are two rules to remember if you want to have a good time. Rule number one, never run out of Colt 45. Rule number two, never forget rule number one. You want to know why you should keep plenty of Colt 45 on hand? You never know when friends might show up. I don't claim you can have a better time with Colt 45 than without it. But why take chances?
The power of Colt 45. It works every time.
It does work every time.
In fact, do we have a new potential sponsor in the line here?
I want Billy D to do all voiceovers.
He's so smooth. Ironically, we ran out of Colt 45 in the first 45 minutes, and we ran out to where else the bodega
to restock. Forgot rule number one.
Yeah, we forgot
rule number one. No, brother. Yeah, because that beer, I bet you can drink pretty easy, right?
A lot of people were complaining of not feeling so well the next day. But
so who are the players in the scene? Like, I mean, you guys couldn't be the first people to do this, but I mean,
No, we would never take credit for that.
Well, find also to, you know, who's out there before and who do you pull from to fill up these events?
Sure. So and that's kind of actually really the problem that we try to solve with Underground Eats, is that we saw that all of these things are actually going on around us a lot more than people realize. There's really amazing food events just kind of beyond the conventional that are happening now. So what we saw is nobody was kind of aggregating these. To be able to keep up on what was going on, you had to follow hundreds of daily emails, newsletters, daily deal sites, or websites to really find out what was going on. And the cool stuff would be sandwiched in between a spa deal and an open bar deal, which are completely just not relevant to obviously to food and good food. So we wanted to be, you know, somebody that could be the go-to destination where we would aggregate and curate the best of the best alternative dining experiences, as we call them. So the best part is there's just a number of really amazing players and characters and cartoons in this space. And Harris, you want to talk about a couple of our best friends we've been working with recently?
Sure. The most recently we've been working with Johnny Cigar, a.k.a. Jonathan Cristaldi from the Noble Rot, who is a self-anointed master sommelier. He's cringing if he's listening to this, but he's very into the wine world. But he's working with a bunch of chefs, Adam Banks from Roblet and Company and Rob McHugh, who's on Hell's Kitchen, and they're creating an event. I believe is it April 14th?
You got it.
They are doing a meal 100 years to the day from the sinking of the Titanic, and they're doing a reinterpretation, a black tie experiential interpretation of the last meal on the Titanic with You know, and it's going to be a crazy event. Actually, we have the last remaining tickets available on our site to this event, and that's what we like, is that these are fleeting events. You're either there or you weren't. If you weren't there, you could read about it, but it's much better to be there. You know, these guys have an amazing amount of energy, and they're ridiculous, and they're so much fun to work with, incredibly creative. And we're working with people like him, and Michael Serino is a good friend from A Razor Is Shiny Knife, and Mike Lee from Studio Feast, and all these guys, they're characters in their own right, but they have visions that are so far beyond what people are doing right now that, you know, we really want to help, you know, promote what they're doing. And we also do a lot of events. We have our launch event on May 20th at Sleep No More in the city, which is pretty exciting.
Very cool. This is just to blow myself because I'm so proud of this. But I was, when I worked for Slow Food, I was invited to a tasting of champagne that had been in the Titanic. I think it was called Heidsick or Heidelsick or something like that.
Yeah, the Heidsick.
They brought it up, and actually that is the perfect place to keep champagne as well, under the water like that. So
I mean,
it wasn't delicious, but it was like...
I'm probably giving away more than I should, and Johnny will be upset, but there are rumors that some very old White Star champagne, which it was the White Star cruise line that had launched the Titanic, maybe popped in celebration. So if you want to go and give a taste to some really old champagne, this may be the place and the time.
Oh, you're going to be in trouble for that one.
Yeah, probably.
Now, how much is it? And I mean, how do people get to your site? It's a members site, right?
Yeah, it is members only. And you know, that's not to be, overly elitist. Exclusive or elitist. But we also know that these experiences are as much about the people that you're sharing them with as it is about the food and all the other elements. So we want people who are passionate about what we're doing to invite their friends who they're passionate about. But we did, Patrick, for you, because we love Heritage Radio and we love Heritage Radio Network. We have a backdoor where all of our listeners can register. And obviously, these are the folks we want at our events. So if everyone listening goes to ugeats.com/heritage, they can all register and share it with your friends and other like-minded gourmands.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. So, all right, Mom, I know you're listening. Sign up. Anyway, no, but...
we would love to have your mother as a member.
That's cool. So, I mean, how is membership going? I mean, I've always asked this question to everybody who's like you, because we're like you. The more people we talk to, the more money we make, the more powerful we are, the more sponsors we get. So, you know, how do you find it? I mean, are you guys just working Facebook and Twitter 3 hours a day, or are you buying lists or renting lists, or how does it work?
We, you know, we're really trying to grow slowly and sensibly and you know, using social media, obviously. We work that pretty hard. But also, you know, our members have been really generous in referring other people. And I think people also just think this stuff is cool and they want to know about it. And so far, it's just been word of mouth. This is literally one of the very first, you know, appearances or interviews that we've done. And we're getting ready to be a little bit more open about what we're up to. But for now, it's just been word of mouth.
So give us, as a final question to each of you guys, the meal. The number one. We've done your website, right? We've covered all that. I want to end on an epiphany here.
Yep.
All right, so...
Well, I've got mine.
You have a...
Shoot.
Let me limit this. You only have a $250,000 budget.
No problem.
Please. For 10 people.
Absolutely.
$25,000 a person.
This is actually one that we've been exploring for the better part of a year. And if you guys are listening, then you'll know, but don't tell anyone. But the idea is that we're going to have an event where it's a relatively high ticket price, but we're not going to tell anyone what they're experiencing. And you're going to meet a very beautiful girl down on a dock somewhere in Manhattan with holding a pink umbrella, and all of a sudden seaplanes are going to roll up. And you're going to get in the seaplane, and we've got a castle secured on the North Shore of Long Island it was a Guggenheim estate at one point. We're going to have a amazingly elevated feast. There may be archers. There may be croquet on the lawn overlooking the Sound, and there may be some really special tastings and famous chefs and just an experience you really won't forget.
Cheese table.
Only if you want.
I'm married to a cheesemonger. Oh, I've always got to say
that. We'll bring Ann.
Don't forget the cheese.
We're going to involve Ann.
Okay. No.
Well, that one's obviously hard to outdo, so I'm going to actually mention one that I recently had that I thought was incredibly memorable and amazing. I recently had dinner at a Buddhist monastery in the East Village with a couple monks, and it was just four people and two monks while they cooked and prepared the food and then kind of relayed their journey, which was pretty incredible, as one of them had started as an investment banker on Wall Street for about 3 years before turning a monk. And there's actually about an overlap there where he was living in the monastery while traveling down Wall Street to work on Wall Street, which is a pretty incredible journey. And I thought that was something that was extremely memorable and a really great example of what alternative dining is about.
Hmm. So mine would be, that's a good one. Yeah, both you guys. I also wanted to ask, before I tell you my one, also I'll ask you at the end, in the future, in 100 years, if this becomes an empire, what would be an interesting underground eats event in 100 years? But my one would be ship all the various animals that are eating as meat fresh from around the world and do a Brazilian churrascaria, you know, where the waiters really know, and you get ox from, you know, Siberia, kudu. Bison, kudu, like anything. It has to be a meat.
I love it.
Good tasting one.
Let's make that happen.
We've actually done a little tasting in the office of some, there are some websites you can go to for exotic meats. We had some turtle and yak and some other.
Beaver tail.
Well, there's the gastronauts. There's that guy, Curtis, I've heard. I was once making a delivery in Palo Santo, and he was bringing, like, beaver tail.
Absolutely, yeah.
They do some wild
examples. They do some great stuff, and they're certainly a forerunner of ours, focused on really unique food, a lot of which maybe I'm not even man enough to get. Speak of, we filmed with Josh Ozersky. We're filming the Ozersky TVs now, and we were just at Maharlika in the East Village. And we subjected Josh to the balut. Are you familiar with balut?
Mm-hmm.
It's a 14-day duck fetus. And it is...
Takes suckling to a new level.
It is a delicacy, and it takes the word delicacy to a whole new level.
Jeez.
There's fully formed beak, but apparently it's very... actually popular in the Philippines, and the proprietors there tell us that as people walk around stadiums here selling Cracker Jacks popcorn, they're walking down the beach going balut, balut.
Oh, man.
And people will eat five or six. I couldn't quite step up to the plate, but
well, you know who was the real first one doing this, maybe not the historical first, but do you know who? You're looking at them. Slow food.
There you go.
That was early in the day. They were the first, but I was the first to bring it to the States, and we had some unusual ones, although nothing like they did. They really tried.
I've been some amazing ones. They would do the crawfish boil down on South Street Seaport, where they'd bring up the truck of fresh crawfish from down south.
No, they were one of the first people to bring up also this idea of food being an educational and the kind of schoolroom technique. They would, absolutely, you know, do 10,000 people over a weekend. It was pretty crazy.
Yeah.
So what is it? What's going to happen next 100 years? Is it just going to be more high-tech food?
Well, we've already been trying to track down Richard Branson to prepare the food on the first galactic flight coming up in about a year.
Now, you're competing with it, because I know Brandon from Roberta's is trying to get him, Richard Branson, to launch the world's biggest dream catcher into the sky.
I'm sure we can collaborate. I like it.
That's going to be... There's a lot on Branson's plate.
Yeah, he's a busy guy. But yeah, that would be... zero gravity food. I mean, how could it get weirder?
Gold.
We want to eliminate plates. We're about sustainability at Underground Eats. So.
Exactly. It'll float. Well, thanks so much for being on, guys. Jack, what's the website again? You got it on there?
Yeah, ugeats.com/heritage, right?
Yep. And if you go to undergroundeats.com, you can see our blog where we're tracking all the movements of the players and interesting things that are happening in the world of alternative dining.
Well, good luck, guys. Onward and upward. Adam Harris, thanks for being on. Jack, great job today. Who's on? We have three new shows, four shows, right? Coming on live
after
this. We've got
four shows. I don't know who Katie's got, but Mike and Judy have Dick Manitoba, who's
they are so
legend.
Awesome, yeah. Those guys. And last week they had the saxophonist from the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, pretty cool.
Unbelievable. Anyway, we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening, everybody.
By the way, I bought some cheese from Anne. you know, after taking those ribeyes from you.
Very nice.
Buy
very
some
nice.
Underground Eats tickets.
Underground Eats tickets, Jack. That's next on your list. And we are a nonprofit. We didn't mention yes. that, but woo, make your donations. Thank you, yeah. everyone.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.